Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Solar Eclipse Eve. Dean Richards, Sunday morning, time for the Week in Health. Dr. Jeremy Silver joining us. Medical Director, Emergency Medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital. Dr. Silver, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Dean. How are you?
Doing very well. We've been talking about the solar eclipse tomorrow and how you shouldn't stare directly at the sun. Talk to us a little bit about what could happen if people ignore all of those warnings, or what kind of health danger there could be at trying to, you know, view this directly.
Well, very simply, you could go blind and lose your vision. So I think it's pretty important to pay attention to what folks are saying about that. The rays from the sun basically go directly back into your retina and can burn the cells of your retina, which is essentially the movie screen of vision. And so it's really important.
Sounds like we've got our phone bug back. I recognize that evil sound anywhere. I haven't had that happen in a long time. Our phone ghost sometimes, knocks out guests that we're talking to on the telephone. So we'll reconnoiter here and get to Dr. Silver. But you heard him say, it couldn't be more plain. You could go blind if you look directly at the sun tomorrow during the eclipse. So, wear the necessary glasses, wear 2-3 pair if you can find them. They're in short supply right now. Or, you do it, through a reflection method. Or it's going to be all over television. So there's another opportunity to watch it and still remain safe. Dr. Silver, before you got taken down by our phone ghost, you were talking about how looking at it could burn the retinas and you could lose your vision. Pick up in there of what could happen, please.
Typically, you might not know it immediately, but slowly over time, the cells of the retina die, and within 12 to 48 hours, you'd be blind, and there's no coming back from that, at least not with today's technology. So there are things you can do, like simply watch the solar eclipse online or on television. NASA is going to be live streaming it. There are eclipse glasses available, as I've read, that are designed to protect the eyes. But I would be careful about buying those. I would check with your eye doctor before you go ahead and put those on and then look directly at the sun. So there's other ways of doing it to keep yourself safe.
Yeah. What about the reflection method? We were, kind of joking a little earlier about when we were kids, you'd get a shoebox and poke a hole in the shoebox. So you could kind of reflect the images, something like that safe to do?
Yeah. So you basically take a box, poke a hole on one side, put a piece of paper in it, a white piece of paper, and then poke another hole that you can see through, and the sun shines through the hole and reflects on the paper, and you can see the reflection. But it's purely a reflection of light as opposed to the actual rays of the sun.
Yeah.
And that's why that technology doesn't hurt the eye. So yes, an eclipse box is perfectly safe.
Okay. Now, is there something unusual about the effects of staring right at the sun during an eclipse? I mean, would the same thing happen if you stared at the sun on any other day?
It would. The thing is, nobody stares at the sun because it's bright, number one, and number two, I think we're all taught that it's dangerous to look directly at it, but I think there's a misconception that when there's an eclipse, somehow there's less light and it's less dangerous, but that's just not the case.
Yeah, well, and it's a once-in-a-while phenomena, so people want to say that they saw it. I remember last time, I guess 2017, where we saw prominent people on television without any kind of eye protection whatsoever, staring directly at it, just completely ignoring all the warnings from health people and just staring directly at it.
And we never heard from them again.
So there you go. There's your warning right there.
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
Yeah. Take the necessary precautions. It's definitely not worth damaging your vision. Well, you know what I've been hearing about a lot all this week? More and more cases of measles and even tuberculosis cases popping up in the Chicago area. You know, these have been cases, I guess, where people have not been vaccinated, with migrants who have come into the Chicago area. But how interesting how quickly this is spreading. I guess you're probably not surprised if you know anything about it, as you do.
No, unfortunately not surprised. You know, given the sort of sagging of vaccination rates over the last few years, that pokes holes in the safety net, the public health safety net. And so we have vulnerable populations, and so unfortunately, that sort of disease that was once pretty much eradicated, not fully, but for the most part, is now active again. I've read there are 58 cases that have been reported. I will say that the Chicago Department of Public Health website indicates that they're providing free vaccines at the Department of Public Health to any child 0 to 18 and any uninsured adult 19 and older. So if you're having second thoughts about maybe getting that that vaccine for your kid or for yourself, you can go get it for free.
Yeah, or people who have, you know, come into this country who, you know, have not been following, you know, our health protocols here. Here's an opportunity to protect yourself and your children from these diseases that we very definitely had under control. Are there visible signs of this if, you know, somebody has been exposed to the measles, you know, for the rest of us? You know, in avoiding, I mean, how contagious are the measles or tuberculosis at this point for the general population?
Measles is extremely contagious. One of the most contagious diseases that you read about, maybe second to Ebola. They say that if you're in a room, if you have 10 people in a room with somebody with measles, 9 of them are going to be infected when they walk out of the room an hour later. It's just that it passes that quickly. And unfortunately, folks are infectious before they realize it. So maybe just a runny nose or even no symptoms at all, they're coughing or breathing these particles into the air, and then you breathe them in, and then you've got the disease. So it's very infectious. Now, TB, on the other hand, measles is a virus. TB is a bacteria that, for the most part, has been under control in the U.S., and it basically tends to blossom or spread in poorly ventilated, crowded areas. And so you think about the migrant shelters, and you've got ideal conditions for spreading of these types of infectious diseases.
Right. Yeah.
Now there are antibiotics, whereas measles, there is no cure other than just your own immune system. In the case of TB, there are antibiotics that are available, but of course there are more and more antibiotic-resistant strains, so it's definitely concerning.
Yeah, protection against this would be the same kinds of protections that we took during the worst of COVID, since measles is airborne. Wearing masks, gloves, all that sort of thing, is that the correct protection for that?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the gloves, you know, as long as you're washing your hands with soap and water, that's probably just as effective as wearing gloves. But definitely the masks are going to help slow and reduce the spread of both diseases. Now, with TB, and I think to measles, we would say the same thing. Those droplets can be very tiny. And so the N95 masks are really the most effective. But if you don't have an N95, then certainly just a regular face mask is better than nothing.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, and if you start to not feel well, whatever, get to your physician, get checked out, because there are definitely some things going around right now that we're not around in these numbers, at least anyway, in the general population. So, you know, all I'm hearing about lately is AI, artificial intelligence, and a variety of fields and lots of different types of industry. I hear about it. I've been following it closely in entertainment, where performances are being replicated by computers, by artificial intelligence. But it's permeating everything. Learn about it, because it's here definitely to stay, and could affect us all greatly. In the healthcare fields, I'm curious how this could be helping us or hurting us in some way. I've heard that pharmaceutical companies now are also getting into AI, and for the life of me, I don't know how that could be applicable in the production of pharmaceuticals.
Sure. Yeah, AI is it's definitely here to stay. And I think for those of us that grew up watching movies like The Terminator, science fiction has become reality. And I think in the case of healthcare, there's definitely opportunity for it to become a real positive. You mentioned pharmaceuticals. AI is simply using computer learning to enhance either research into disease or treatment. And so in the case of pharmaceuticals, you can vastly speed up the process of drug development, because you can run algorithms that would replicate things that you might do in the lab that would take months. You can do over a weekend with a series of very fast computers. So you can imagine that bringing a drug to market in the space of a year as opposed to 10 years, how that would both be beneficial for the company, but also for the end user, for the patient. And we see AI already being utilized in, for instance, in diagnostic radiology, where the human eye may not be able to catch subtle patterns that are present in, for instance, early cancer. So for mammography, where we use x-rays to diagnose abnormalities in breast tissue, the computer is looking at this and saying, no, wait a second, focus in on this one area here. I'm detecting a pattern. And the physician can then say, wow, you know, hey, here's something I didn't even see. You know, let's take a closer look with an MRI, or this is very concerning. I'm going to call their doctor. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to use this technology for good. But of course, in humankind, we tend to then muck things up and get excited and rush to try and take advantage of things. There's also the downside, which is, of course, the technology then kind of becomes smarter than the human and takes over. And I think that's the major concern with all of these technologies.
Yeah, that's what I've heard over and over and over again, that people who know a lot more about this than I do are fearing that these computers that you're talking about that speed up and assist the humans right now can, you know, develop their own patterns of learning to where they do become smarter than the humans. You know, and who's to say that AI wouldn't become your personal physician, that a computer becomes your, you know, your personal physician and, you know, takes over your entire medical care. I don't think I would be comfortable with something like that.
Well, certainly folks of our era, Dean, I think would probably be hesitant. You wonder with the newer generation and their comfort with machines and machine learning and technology, how they're going to feel in 20 years when they grow up and go to college. But I share your concern. I think, you know, if you take the analogy of calculators, when we moved from the slide rule, which my dad used in high school to calculate equations and math, to the calculator, you still have to check your work. And I think that's the key here, is that we still have to check these computers' work. You still need a human to say, well, wait a second, does this make sense? Does this square with what I'm seeing? Does this fit the clinical context? And do I agree? And I think those are the controls that need to be in place across any industry that this is being utilized in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, does anybody else feel uncomfortable when you go to, you know, Google something, you look up something on Google, and it's anticipating what it is that you're asking about, and suddenly you're flooded with ads and things about that very subject again. The computer is, it has sort of taken over your thinking process there. And
well, not just that, but you know, you see a video of a star like a Beyonce or a Justin Timberlake, and then you 2 minutes later somebody says, "Well, that's a deep fake. It's not really who you thought it was."
Well, right.
So you really have to question the information that's being put in front of you.
Yeah. Well, there was a lawsuit that was settled this week with the estate of George Carlin. Somebody had created a video that talked like Carlin, sounded like Carlin, looked like Carlin, but was not Carlin. The family of George Carlin sued, and the case was settled out of court, and the video was taken out of circulation because it so closely replicated George Carlin, you know, completely through computer technology, which 100% creeps me out. Are there applications of AI in medicine now that are being used? I mean, I presume that computers are assisting in, you know, lots of different procedures that go on in hospitals and doctors' offices now.
There are, certainly in the radiology world. And then, of course, speech recognition to transcribe medical documents. So that's a job that a human used to have, and now a computer can handle it. There's a human that has to double check for errors, but my understanding is many companies are using that service, you know, across the board. So, you know, in oncology, for instance, you have AI aggregating all the latest studies to assist the physician. You know, there's so many drugs in the world of cancer treatment, and so many studies that are now available, and the treatment for one patient might be just a little bit different than the next, even with the same disease. Maybe the same age group, but their genetics are slightly different, and you simply can't stay on top of all that as a physician. And so you have these computer algorithms that help you say, oh, well, this person gets this particular tailored therapy, and this person gets a slightly different therapy. So yes, it is being used currently.
So it sounds like you're leaning toward AI in medicine is a good thing, and healthcare is a good thing.
Well, I think it can be. I would say that I would embrace it cautiously, like anything else. There's an opportunity for it to become an augmentation to the physician. But like you say, if we start taking people out of the equation, that's when it gets a little dangerous and sketchy. In my opinion, the
847 area code texts in a question for Dr. Jeremy Silver, asking, "Can you tell me about the health risks of vaping? I was in an elevator recently. A person got in, took out their vape cigarette, whatever those things are called now, the electronic cigarettes, and was vaping away." Is that safer or less safe than smoking cigarettes?
Well, I think that is a good question. And in some cases, in some ways, yes, vaping is safer, certainly for the individual, in the sense that we don't see the same association of cancer at this point that we do with inhaled tobacco products. But you're still inhaling ultra-fine particles into the lungs. There are flavorants in these compounds that can cause lung disease, and we have seen patterns of disease in folks that vape. I'm not aware of the third party being affected, so like secondary smoke, secondhand smoke. I'm not aware of secondhand vape illness, but then yeah, I don't know that we've studied people that live in houses where there's vaping occurring. So, you know, personally, I don't like inhaling secondhand vaping humors, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think there's an opportunity for folks to get off of tobacco using these vaping products. We know that folks that vape are significantly less likely to then be going back to their tobacco products. But then you have you're still addicted to nicotine, and there's still an issue there. So yeah. To be continued.
Yeah, we will discuss this again. Dr. Jeremy Silver is an actual human being and not AI. He is the medical director of Emergency Medicine Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital. Dr. Silver, have a great day today. Thank you.
Dean, take care. Thanks again.